Herzlich willkommen. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und ich freue mich sehr, euch heute zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers begrüßen zu dürfen. Ich bin heute hier in Helsinki und treffe mich mit Mikko Hyppinen. Er ist Chief Research Officer bei WithSecure, einer B2B Cybersecurity Company mit Sitz in Helsinki. Von hier aus unterstützt er zusammen mit seinem Team Unternehmen auf der ganzen Welt dabei, ihre IT-Infrastruktur und Daten besser abzusichern. Mit was vernetzt ist, ist angreifbar, hat Hyppinen gerade erst sein erstes Buch veröffentlicht und geht dabei der Frage nach, wie Geheimdienste und Kriminelle uns im Netz infiltrieren. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, wie es eigentlich momentan um Cybersecurity steht, wie gut Unternehmen in der Regel aufgestellt sind und welchen Impact Quantum Computing auf unsere Cybersicherheit haben könnte. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Mikko, thank you so much for meeting me here in Helsinki and inviting me to your beautiful office with such a beautiful sea view.
Thanks for coming by, Daniel.
So you wrote a book. You actually, I think the first idea for that book you had like 10 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Actually, more than 10 years ago. The initial idea was in 2011. And the book really started when I got off the TED stage. I did a TED talk in 2011, and TED talks always get a lot of views online, and they are a big deal. As soon as I got off the stage and got home, I started getting emails from US book publishers and book agents that, hey, Mikko, you should write a book. All TED speakers write a book. Write a book. So I agreed. Okay, sure. Sounds like a good idea. Maybe I should write a book. I'm sure I would have a lot of things to tell about the things I've seen since I've been working with computer security since 1991. And I've seen how the society got online and how crime and risks got online. So I started writing a book and I kept changing the topic. I was writing a book about reverse engineering malware. Then I was writing a book about cyber war. Then I was writing a book about geopolitics and how spying has gone online. And it wasn't really going anywhere because at the very same time, I was traveling the world and doing a lot of meetings and trying to write a book on planes and airport lounges and hotels. Wasn't really going anywhere. So the saving grace for the book project was the pandemic. When the pandemic started in 2020, then I had no excuses. Then I really had to write the book. And that's when I really started working on it proper. And I'm really glad I was able to finish it. And I'm also very happy about the fact that I wrote the book before GPT-3 or GPT-4. So it's actually fully human written.
If I remember correctly, you started out in cybersecurity more or less in 1987 by discovering your first virus, or more or less getting in contact with your first virus, right?
That's right. That's when I got infected for the first time. The virus was called Crew 2480, a very simple MS-DOS-based virus. This is time before Windows, time before internet, time of 5 1/4-inch floppy disks. I was born in 1969, so I was a young student at the time, and that's when I got infected. And at the time, I was fascinated. Like, what is this thing spreading from one computer to another, from one city to another, from one country to another? How does this actually work? And I had programming experience before that. I had like professionally programmed on 8-bit home computers. I had been selling turbo loaders for Commodore 64s. I made several commercial games for Commodore 64 as a teenager. And to be able to program those early home computers, you needed a lot of low-level programming knowledge in assembler. And I started to apply those skills to reverse engineer these MS-DOS-based viruses to understand how they worked. And that really got me into where I am today. That got me to professionally start to analyze malware, and that got me into the whole computer crime area and eventually cybercrime, as we call it today.
And ever since cybercrime developed into a proper business model, now there are so many viruses and whatever that earn money by locking data, by encrypting files and stuff like that. So what was the point where you realized that it develops from a, let's call it a nerd topic, from people that played around and wanted to try out what is working and what is not working, into something that became a proper threat for companies and also a business model?
In the early days, analyzing attacks by hobbyist virus writers was more like a game. It was more like playing a game of chess against an unknown player. Like, it was exciting. We would find a new virus spreading on floppy disks somewhere in the world, and we would eagerly wait to get a sample, and we would analyze it, we would crack it, and we would name it and create descriptions, and then we would eagerly wait for the next one. And the attackers were kids, like teenage boys writing viruses for fun. It wasn't, in that sense, very serious, even though many of these viruses were destructive, so they were causing real problems for the infected companies. But the game really changed in the early 2000s. Around 2003, we started finding viruses which were spreading online because internet was already a thing. And once they infected large amounts of computers, those computers or access to those infected computers was sold to spammers, email spammers, who were using those infected computers to send email spam. And of course, spam is being sent to make money. That's when money entered the picture. And that really changed everything. Very quickly afterwards, we started seeing banking trojans, which would move money to wrong accounts when you were doing online banking from infected computers. Then we started seeing key loggers, which would collect credit card numbers when you were doing online payments or using online shopping. And then we started seeing ransomware. And ransomware is the biggest malware problem still today. We found the very first Bitcoin-enabled ransomware in 2013, so pretty much 10 years ago. And during those 10 years, ransomware has become such a big problem that nowadays, when I speak about the largest organized cybercrime gangs, I refer to them as cybercrime unicorns.
We met 2 weeks ago in Munich, and you did a presentation there, and you showed a couple of pages of those big, you can even call them corporations, like
gangs.
Yeah, let's call them gangs. They even have platforms today where they show or kind of present what companies they hacked and or which files they locked and how much money they want for unlocking that again. How is it possible that those gangs got so big?
The reason why I call them cybercrime unicorns is really to highlight the fact that in many ways they are like technology startup companies, unicorn companies. They are highly profitable, highly valuable. And if they would be legal companies, they would be probably considered to be unicorns. The amount of money they make is significant. And to make matters worse, since they collect the ransom in bitcoins and in other cryptocurrencies, and they've been doing it for years, the valuations of the money cryptocurrencies they've been holding in many cases has skyrocketed, making them even more wealthier. And some of these gangs invest their profits actively back into their operations. That's how they've become so organized. That's how they've become so company-like. They are not that different from real-world organized crime gangs, which are also very organized and resemble real-world companies in many ways. So in the online world, the largest gangs are groups like Lockbit, Clop, Alpha, Quantum, RansomX, Black Pasta, and many others. And they run websites. They have brand names. They have logos. They have their own data centers. They have their own HR teams. They have their own lawyers. They have their own business analysts, maybe. So in that sense, it is very professional. These are professional criminals. And I especially find it fascinating that they really do branding. They have names, they have logos. And the reason why they do branding is that they need a reputation. They need a scary reputation, but also a reputation that if you work with them, they deliver. The worst reputation a ransomware gang could have is a reputation that if you get hit and you pay the ransom, you're still not going to get your files back, and they will still leak all the stolen files on a website. If that's the reputation you have, then nobody will pay the ransom. So they really try to deliver. They have tech support teams which will work with victims which pay the ransom to make sure they're happy, to make sure they really get the files back. They promise not to attack you again, and they will not attack you again. They promise not to leak the files, and they will not leak the files. They are building a reputation that they are honest criminals.
For organizations that act in public like they are, why is it so hard to track them down?
We have been building technologies which make all of this possible. The thing about technology innovations is when we invent something, we cannot uninvent it. We cannot make it go away. And whenever we speak about technology being misused, we often get these excuses how technology is just a tool. Technology is innocent. It's a tool. You can use it for good or you can use it for bad. And I don't actually like that. I think it's much more complicated than that. Technology has a responsibility as well. And yes, almost any technology can be used for good and bad. Internet is the best thing which has happened during our lifetime. I love the internet. It has enabled so much good, so much communication, so much, you know, many new business opportunities, so many new forms of entertainment. But at the same time, it has enabled global crime, global risks. Conspiracy theories thrive today better than ever before. Election meddling, cyber war, all of this has happened as a downside of the same thing. Another example, encryption. Encryption, which enables us to have some resemblance of privacy online, which enables us to do business online, which enables us to communicate in privacy. Same time, unencrypted encryption means bad people, terrorists, extremists, criminals can use encryption as well. Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, you could say the same thing. And once we have invented things like uncrackable encryption, we cannot make it go away. The only thing we can try to do is to make it illegal. And that doesn't work because the innovation has been done and we cannot make it go away. If we make something illegal, you're not allowed to use cryptocurrencies or you're not allowed to use strong encryption, then of course, you and me, law-abiding citizens, then we wouldn't be using those technologies because they would be illegal. But you know who would still be using those technologies? Well, criminals would be using those technologies because criminals are criminals because they break the laws. They would break this law as well. And this is the challenge we face with technology. And this is the answer to your question, why can't we find these people? They're using technologies like Tor. They're using technologies like Bitcoin, technologies like uncrackable encryption. These things are fairly, almost entirely untrackable because they've been built to be untrackable, and we cannot make them go away because we cannot make inventions go away. We cannot uninvent things.
You just said that if you get attacked by one of those gangs and you pay them, you will get your data back and they are not going to attack you again. So would you recommend actually paying those gangs, or is there any better option if you get attacked?
I would never recommend to anyone to pay the ransom. That's really easy to say and really hard to do. But it's pretty obvious. The more ransoms get paid, the bigger this problem becomes. The more powerful these gangs will become, the more gangs we will have. There's a lot of money as long as people, or typically enterprises, pay the ransom. And the largest ransoms we've seen have been in tens of millions of euros. So there's really a lot of money in just one individual ransom case, and there's tons and tons of these cases. Whenever you visit the Tor websites for these large ransomware gangs and you just scroll down the list of victims. There's hundreds and hundreds of companies of all sizes, of all business areas, everywhere in the world. It is really eye-opening when you realize how big the problem really is. So this problem isn't going to go away anytime soon, and the more companies pay the ransom, the longer we will have this problem. We've had the first 10 years now. It's going to go on at least for another 10 years. And the reason why it's so hard not to pay the ransom is not just companies wouldn't have backups. Companies do have backups. Actually, backups have become much better over the last decade because of ransomware problem. Companies have realized that, yes, backups are, you know, offline backups are mandatory. We might get hit by ransomware. It's not just that you're worried about a fire at your data center or something like that. It's actually much more concrete. The problem isn't really that your files get encrypted. The problem is these leak sites. All of these large gangs first steal your files. They steal your document archives. They steal your email archives. Then they encrypt them. And if you don't pay the ransom, they have these dedicated leak sites where they will be leaking this content. As we are recording this podcast, for example, PwC, PricewaterhouseCooper, is right now having some of their files leaked online by one of the attacking gangs because they haven't paid the ransom. They are doing the right thing. As an end result, some of their clients' and customers' data is being leaked online. And this kind of data and this kind of data leak is highly damaging because it's not just financial information and planning information or information about publicly traded stocks. It's also things like your employees' private email communication with the corporate healthcare about their private health issues, things like that. All kinds of things that you would never want to have publicly available online will become publicly available online. And these are the kinds of questions decision makers in companies have to answer when they are faced with the question, should we pay the ransom or should we not pay the ransom? And it's interesting that when you speak with decision makers in large companies, when you speak with board members or leadership team members, they all agree that, yeah, data is money. Data is the most valuable thing we have. They all say these things, but they never put a money figure on the data, on the value of the data the company holds until they're faced with something like this. Then they get hit by ransomware. Then they have to concretely answer the question, like, is our data worth 10 million euros or is it not? That's the first time they actually have to really think about the real value of the data.
We are sitting inside of a cybersecurity company right now, and you're working for them for many, 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 many years.
32.
And like, how effective, how secure can cybersecurity be nowadays?
Sometimes people ask me that, tell me, Mikko, how come we can't build an unhackable operating system or an unhackable application? And the problem is, all these things that we are running are built by humans, by programmers. Humans make mistakes. When programmers make mistakes, we end up with bugs. And when we have bugs in interconnected systems, those bugs become vulnerabilities, vulnerabilities which can be exploited. So it's just a question of mistakes made by programmers. And as long as our programs are written by humans, we will have mistakes. That might eventually change. Eventually, most of our programs might be written by other programs, which might make much less mistakes. We'll see. We're already seeing AI, programming AIs. But this is the real reason. And that means it's the same question as to, could we ever build an unpickable lock? If you would take the best locksmith on the planet and give him €1 million and task him to build an unpickable lock, would that lock be unpickable? Probably not. It would probably be very, very hard to pick. But you could then take 100 next best locksmiths and give them €10 million and task them to pick the lock, and they would probably pick the lock. So anything a man can build, other men can unbuild. And this applies to computer security as well. And that's the basic problem we have. So we will be needing computer security as long as there are bad people on the planet. And I don't think we'll be running out of bad people on the planet anytime soon. As long as we have bad people, we have attackers going after easy targets like easily hackable computers.
Nowadays, we not only have bad people working in private gangs, but we do also have government motivated hackers, let's put it that way, maybe. What is more dangerous, or what are you more afraid of, private hacker gangs or government related hackers?
When I speak with our clients and customers, I always emphasize that before they start to really build their cybersecurity strategy, they should really first do their threat assessments. Like who are we? What do we do? Like, what is our company? Who are we worried about? Who doesn't like us? Who would like to hurt us? Who would like to steal from us? Who would like to make us look bad? Would our competitors be interested in spying on us? Are we doing something that would make us a target of foreign governments and foreign intelligence agencies? During times of crisis, maybe during times of war, would we be a target for a foreign nation state? Questions like these. And the answers to these questions are very different for different companies. If you're running a large chain of pizza restaurants, you don't really have to worry about foreign nation states. If you are running a defense contractor, you do worry about nation states. However, the pizza restaurant chain very much has to worry about criminal attackers, because they have a lot of financial information floating around, a lot of payroll data, credit card data, payment terminals, banking interaction systems. So they should be building their defense around fighting financially motivated criminals. Defense contractor should build their strategy around defending against foreign intelligence agencies and foreign governmental attackers. And it's much, much more common to get hit by financially motivated criminals. It's actually very rare to get hit by governmental attackers. You have to be doing something fairly special to be hit by governmental attackers. The way you can think about it is that if your organization, if you're working for an organization which has been around for decades, if you didn't worry about real-world spies in the 1980s and 1990s, then you probably don't have to worry about online spies today. So it's really about the threat assessment. But governments are very much using online attacks to get what they want. And when we look at the different things governments are trying to do with offensive cyber power, it's almost always espionage or sabotage. That's the rough split to two. Most of the attacks governments do, Chinese, Russian, Western governments, is about spying. Spying has always been about collecting information. Information used to be physical. It used to be somewhere. You had to go to the building which had the drawings or the plans or the paper with the information to steal or copy or photograph the information. You know, James Bond stuff. Today, information is data. You don't have to go anywhere. If you can gain access to the systems, you can steal the information. And that's the espionage part. Then the sabotage part looks like things like Stuxnet, sabotaging systems to destroy things. In Ukraine, we are seeing things like attacking Ukrainian governmental systems to wipe them, which is done by Russian attacks coming from GRU right now. And sabotage during wartime isn't sabotage anymore. Then it's war. And in Ukraine, for example, we are seeing very concrete cyber war. And then there is one exception to this split into two. Every other government all around the world, when they do offensive use of cyber power, they're doing it for either espionage or for sabotage. And the exception is North Korea. North Korea is the only government in the world which is doing offensive cyber attacks to make money. There's no other government which does this. North Korea has been doing it over and over again, including using ransomware to make bitcoins for the North Korean government, including hacking foreign national banks, hacking the SWIFT banking systems to make money, and multiple times hacking cryptocurrency exchanges to steal cryptocurrencies. North Korea is the most sanctioned government in the world, and they know that the only unsanctionable currency are cryptocurrencies, or unsanctionable currencies are cryptocurrencies. So that's why they are focusing their attacks into that. And that's really unusual and really weird, but that's the only government which is doing cyber attacks to make money.
Would you say that the West or Europe especially is at the beginning of a cyber war with Russia or even China?
Not really. Most of the attacks the West is seeing are espionage. Espionage and spying. And espionage is espionage, spying is spying, war is war. The thing that we are seeing, for example, in Germany or in Finland, is spying from Russia, from China, from some other countries. Well, we're even seeing spying from the United States. It's happening in Europe as well. And we wouldn't call that a war. We have to remember that real world espionage still happens. It hasn't disappeared. It's a real thing as well. We have real world spies as well. And we don't call that a war. When we find Russian spies, we just ask them to leave the country and go back to Russia. We don't call that a military strike. We don't call that a war. Same thing should apply to online things as well. So the thing we should be worried about in the West is spying. That's happening today. Of course, if we would face a major crisis, if we would face a war, then cyber war would be a very real thing, just like we're seeing right now in Ukraine. But that's not what we're seeing today. What we're seeing today, what's happening every day, is spying.
You talked about unhackable encryption, and just a couple of weeks ago, in early July, we learned that Google's quantum computer was processing with 70 qubits and thereby was 240 times faster than the fastest supercomputer, like traditional supercomputer. What does that mean? What does quantum mean for encryption? What does quantum mean for cybersecurity? And how far are we from danger connected to quantum computing?
Here in our headquarters, we're sitting 5 kilometers away from Otaniemi area, which is the campus for the biggest technological university in Finland. Aalto University has been, it used to be called TKK, and they've been building research on cold temperatures since the 1980s. And I remember this cold lab they've had for decades. They were doing world-class research, including the fact that the coldest place on Earth for many, many years was here in Finland, in the lab of this university. And I remember 10 years ago or more, there were often like questions like, why are you researching cold? Like, what's the point of having the coldest place in the world here in Finland? Why are you doing this? People were laughing about this research. Well, they're not laughing anymore. Quantum computers operate at -273. Pretty much all quantum computers in the world are running on Finnish technology based on the research done at this university. This is the importance of basic research. Basic research comes up with things we couldn't imagine when the research was started. There's a quantum computing company in Otaniemi as well called IQM. I've been there. I've actually touched a quantum computer over there. They're really cool, literally really cool. It's the only company I know which has actually been selling working quantum computers. There's a lot of research computers like Google's computers, but this company has actually been selling quantum computers already, including, believed, I think they sold one to Germany. And quantum computers will change the world in many ways. The two things which apply here is machine learning. Quantum computers will change the way we teach AI systems. And they will crack big part of the encryption algorithms we use. The way I explain why quantum computers are such a big deal for encryption is that quantum computers work differently because they can do multiple things at the same time. Traditional encryption algorithms, in their most basic way, are secure because they operate with very large numbers. So if you imagine taking a pocket calculator and punching in a large number, let's say 5 digits or 10 digits, and then you multiply it with another large number, 5 or 10 digits, you end up with a very, very large number. And you can do it on your pocket calculator in seconds. It's very easy to do calculations that way. But then imagine that someone gives you the end result, the large number that came out of those two numbers, and asks you that, hey, this number was created by multiplying two large numbers with each other. What were those numbers? There's no way for you to figure it out. Like, how the hell would you know? The only way for you to figure out what the original two numbers were would be to try multiplying all numbers with all numbers. You could have a computer try multiplying 2 by 3, 2 by 4, 2 by 5, 2 by 6, until it ends up with millions multiplied by millions. It's going to take, well, to crack current encryption algorithms, it would take hundreds of millions of years, even if you would be using all the computers on the planet. This is why we have uncrackable encryption. Once we have enough qubits in quantum computers, they won't have to go through number by number. They would calculate this by multiplying all numbers with all other numbers in the first step. And they would crack pretty much every encryption algorithm we use today, including everything you use to do online shopping or the encryption protecting WhatsApp or Signal messaging. Pretty much the only thing which wouldn't break would be Bitcoin. Bitcoin, designed by Satoshi Nakamoto in 2008, already was thinking about quantum weak algorithms. It's been designed to be quantum safe. If you use a new address for every transaction, it cannot be cracked by quantum computers. So we already have the solution. We know how to create quantum safe hashing or quantum safe algorithms for encryption. We're simply not using them. And this is a crisis. This is an emergency. And I'm seeing nobody worrying about this. We should be right now changing all the algorithms in every browser, on every computer, in every phone, in every car, in every fridge to quantum safe algorithms. Because if we start now, we might be finished with that project in 10 years. And in 10 years, we probably have quantum computers which will be able to break these. And we're not doing that. I don't sense the emergency at all. It's going to be a real problem when we have enough qubits.
Maybe bit of a personal question, because I could imagine that some of our listeners are getting a little curious about that. How is someone like you protecting himself from attacks?
Trick question. Why would I discuss that publicly? That would be very bad OPSEC. I have a policy of not discussing my personal safety and security at all. I'll just say that I do it very carefully.
Is there something you could recommend for everyone who's listening? What should we do and what should we avoid?
Well, what I'll say is the things that I would recommend to anyone thinking about their security. Three basic steps, which none of our rocket science. Step number one, backups. Step number two, patching. Step number three, passwords. So backups first. Back up your data, back up your phone, back up your tablet, back up your backups. And make sure you have backups so that even if your house burns down, you have backups. So at the very basic level for your home data, like your holiday photos or pictures of your children growing up, back them up on a removable hard drive, take the hard drive to grandmother's or to your office somewhere. Just think about your house and every computing device in your house, your phones, your hard drives burning down. Would you still have your holiday photos? That's the first thing. Step number two, patching. Make sure your systems are up to date. Whenever you get prompted about something that this has to be updated, update it. The reason typically is security. When you get a prompt from iPhone that there's a new operating system, take it. So patching, keeping up to date. And then passwords. I've been fighting passwords all my life. I mean, I can't wait them to die. We all have to remember all too many passwords. So use two-factor authentication, use passkeys, use biometric authentication wherever you can. For example, iPhone Face ID is actually very safe and it's very privacy-centric as well. And passkeys, which is now coming out from Microsoft, from Apple and from Google, is hopefully going to make passwords die. And I can't wait for that to happen.
Your book basically says that everything that is smart or connected can be attacked. What does that mean for all those nice little devices we got used to when it comes to smart home, like smart light bulbs, smart locks, smart whatever, smart speakers? Would you say that we should avoid those things, or is it not that dangerous?
The example I always use about smart devices is my wristwatch. I'm carrying a Omega Seamaster 300, which I've been carrying for 21 years, which is a completely mechanical watch. No Bluetooth, no Wi-Fi, no CPU, no code. How did you hack my watch? Well, you don't. There's nothing to hack. Then when you look at Apple watches or Android watches or Garmin's or Suunto's, they might be very safe. For example, Apple watches are very safe, but are they completely unhackable? No. It's running code. It's online. It was designed by humans. There are mistakes. That's the same thing that applies to anything which is connected. And yes, everything will be connected. The Internet Revolution's first wave took computers online. Today, all computers are already online. The second wave, the current wave, will take everything else online. And yes, the Hyppönen law, if it's smart, it's vulnerable, is a very pessimistic law, but it's also true. And we can't avoid this. Everything will be online, whether we like it or not. You can't stay outside of this revolution. Eventually, the things you buy will be online and you don't even know that they are online and there's no way for you to keep them offline. So we just have to accept the thing that everything we will be using, if not yet in the future, will be connected and will be vulnerable. We'll just have to realize and work accordingly to understand that these things cannot completely be protected. There's plenty of upsides. I mean, I like the fact that, for example, you can have a security camera which you can watch from your mobile phone anywhere on the planet. That's very useful. But of course, it comes with a price. We have upsides and downsides. In security, everything is a trade-off.
What would be a secure computer? How would it look like? How would it has to be designed?
A fairly large part of the listeners actually owns a version of Windows which is much more secure than any other version of Windows. I'm guessing maybe 5% of the people listening right now, maybe more, have a computer in their home which is running a version of Windows which only runs whitelisted applications and refuses to run any applications which it doesn't know about. A version of Windows which only does encrypted IPv6 network traffic and refuses to do anything else. A version of Windows which supports no scripting languages or batches or PowerShell or anything like that. The version of Windows I'm speaking about is the version of Windows inside Microsoft Xbox, the gaming console. The most secure version of the operating system made by the biggest software company on the planet is inside a gaming console, which sounds a little bit weird, doesn't it? You would think that the most secure version of Windows is inside some military-grade laptop or in some payment terminal or something like that. It's not. It's in a gaming console. The reason why it's like that is that gaming consoles have a unique threat model. They have to protect the system against outside attackers, but also against the owner of the device. And the traditional wisdom has been that if you can touch a device, then you can do anything you want with the device. Well, that's not true with Xboxes. Xboxes are closed so well that even the owner can't jailbreak the device or run his own code on the device. So what's the lesson here? Well, Xboxes run basically on the same architecture than your iPhone. Your iPhone is a computer. Your iPad is a computer, but it's a closed computer. It's a computer you're not allowed to program. Even though you own the computer, you're not allowed to program it. The only way you can run programs is to write a program and then send it to Apple to California to be approved. And if Apple approves your code, then you get the right to run it on your own computer. And that's a very, very restrictive model, but it's also a very safe model. And this is the reason why you never hear about malware outbreaks on Xboxes or worms spreading on iPhones. So again, it's a trade-off. We are giving away the right to program our own computers. But as an end result, we get much better security. And turns out, most users of computers aren't programmers to begin with.
So does that mean that iPhones and iPads are more or less pretty safe?
If you have to do something which requires a very high level of security, let's say you're going to move a lot of money from your account to another account, it's actually much more safer to do it on an iPad than on your MacBook or on your Windows computer. So yeah, these more restrictive devices are much better in security in practice. They're not completely unhackable, but they're much safer than the alternatives.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.